This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Welcome to Resolved Mysteries.
Hi.
Hi.
This is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to the cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Allison.
I'm Eliza.
And I'm Carlin.
And welcome. We're so happy to have you. And this is the season premiere of season 4. So we're so excited.
It's pretty wild. It's pretty wild.
We have made it to the season premiere of season 4. Who would have thought? Never us. As you probably know, but if you're a new listener, welcome. For every review that we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization, and this month's organization is the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. Their mission is to build collective power with AAPI women and girls to gain full agency over their lives, their families, and their communities. We're also still doing a magnet giveaway! So we still have some magnets to give away. If you leave a review for us, screen grab the review and email us at resolvedmysteriespodcast@gmail.com. With your address, we're going to send you a magnet.
Yeah.
Also, if you'd like to support us on Patreon, you'll get ad-free episodes, 2 additional episodes a month, early access to some episodes, and you'll get some goodies in the mail. Go to patreon.com/resolvedmysteriespodcast to support us. All right. What are we covering for the season 4 premiere?
Okay, so I have an unexplained segment of the Rendlesham Forest incident.
And then I have the unexplained death of Shane Stewart and Sally McNelly.
And then I have a lost loves about Carla Downing.
All right, let's do it. Season 4. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Woo, woo. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. So we have for you today, as a season opener, why shouldn't it be a UFO segment? Why not? And why wouldn't it? So this is the Rendlesham Forest incident, and some people call it like the UK's Roswell. It's one of the most quote-unquote well-documented UFO sightings in England. So here we go. First of all, as I mentioned in last episode, UM did decide to give a full 20 minutes to the segment and about 5 to the other 2. So
you have to go with what's really important. The people need to know. You have to bring the news to the people.
I mean, the story is kind of long, though.
It's long.
It is. It is.
I had Elliot. Was Elliot Ness the Nazi, terrible Nazi guy?
No. Rudolf Hess.
Oh, yeah, Ness is the detective?
Very different, yes.
Hess and Ness. Hess and Ness. Rudolf Hess, that was maybe our longest segment ever.
Yeah,
so
that was
long.
Really long.
Oh, my God. I'm here for here. This one.
I'm here for it, too. There's a lot of people that saw this, and they're not weirdos in the middle of nowhere, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. I still think it's a... So whenever things like this happen, it can be you want to see it, and I'll get into it, obviously, but just be keeping in mind, like, what do you think? Do you think these people heard that people saw it the night before, so then they wanted to see it? Mm-hmm. Is it a groupthink situation? Mm-hmm. Is it other things that they're taking for a UFO, but it's really something else, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, the usual suspects of these alien close encounters. Yeah.
The story... changes a bit depending on who's telling it. So here we go. It's sometimes also called the Brent Waters UFO situation. So in Rendlesham Forest in England, it is home to America's Woodbridge Air Force Base. On December 26th, 1980, at around 2 a.m., Airman First Class John Burroughs and his partner were on routine patrol along the base perimeter. The base was nearly empty, but according to Sergeant Burroughs, something bright was lighting up the nearby woods, and Burroughs is in this segment a lot. He's the one who wears, like, the reddish-pink striped shirt, I think. Mm. He's got that mustache, of course, you know. He says, there was definitely something out in the woods. It seemed to me like a massive light show. Oh, I have to say, too, I was so excited that this took place in England because I thought, oh, I'm going to get to hear so many accents. No, it's just a bunch of freaking American people.
I know. I had that thought, too.
It's none of the benefits of an English case.
How disappointing.
Because I'm still listening to Americans. He said, it seemed to me like a massive light show. I was nervous. He was nervous. We didn't know what to expect, and we decided at that point that we better get back and let somebody know what's going on in case something did happen. And they didn't do a great job of explaining this in this segment, but this is around the time of the Cold War. So They would be maybe on high alert for something. Mm-hmm. for something. Rather than just like... It just puts a little more context maybe into how they were feeling.
Totally, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Burroughs quickly notified his immediate superior, and in minutes, another security patrol arrived. They had also seen the strange lights where they were doing their routine patrol. So Burroughs, in the reenactment, Burroughs' partner is still in the truck, and Burroughs is like, are you coming? And the partner says, nope. Like, I'm not. And he just stays there. So Burroughs and this is like, okay, maybe you're not cut out for this job. So Burroughs and the second security team went off base to investigate. And I thought this was interesting. They had to leave their weapons behind because they were moving out of American jurisdiction.
Yeah. Oh.
So they left all their weapons in their trucks and they open the gates and they just walk out on foot, unarmed.
Huh.
Burroughs says, we didn't know what we were getting into. We started in on foot towards the lights. At the same time, we could hear the animals. They were very upset because you could hear a lot of ruckus.
Oh, no.
And this is a point he comes back to a few times. Like, they just seemed so upset. What was upsetting the animals in the forest?
I mean, that is, like, one of the scariest parts to me.
That's pretty creepy.
If the animals in the forest are, like, peace out.
Trying to tell you something. It's also nighttime, so, like...
It's even scarier because they should be sleeping in their little tree homes.
Well, a lot of forest animals are nocturnal. So you would also think that maybe they make noise anyway. But when you're thinking something weird's happening, you're starting to also notice the animals making noise. I mean, I'm sure there was more noise, but I don't know. Also, there's humans walking around their home. So maybe they don't like that.
And there's also, if they're nocturnal, there's also bright lights, which they're not used to. So that would make them
nervous. Yeah, whatever
anyway.
These lights are.
Yeah.
Yeah. At this point, we had a radio transmission. They'd just gotten contact from Heathrow Tower in London that an object had been seen over our base and that it had disappeared on radar. So that is kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, in the clearing, there was an object. It had a bank of blue lights on it. And it was sitting there strobing. It was unbelievable. Don't worry, we've got screenshots to show you. Then they had to do quite a stunt in this reenactment. You can't really tell why they did this, but they decide to just hit the ground out of nowhere.
Yes.
And then after they hit the ground, that's when this thing that they're seeing kind of rises up and then goes away.
So, and I think that was not interpreting it quite right. Because to me, maybe. What made sense is as soon as it started rising, they were like, holy
they
shit.
They would threw hit to the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But had it like totally discombobulated.
The reenactment's not great of the order of things. He says, we all hit the ground and it went up into the trees. When it was happening, everything seemed to go slower. We seemed to be in like... I wouldn't say a time warp, but like everything was happening slower to us and everything felt different. For more than 2 hours, Sergeant Burroughs said he and the two other men played a game of cat and mouse with the mysterious craft. So that was interesting. I thought, oh, it's just going to go away. But they were able to just kind of keep following what they thought they were seeing.
That's crazy.
And it always stayed out in the distance at the horizon. And sometimes it appeared to get close and then it would go far away again. But it was never as close to them as that first time when they really had to hit the dirt.
They really had to hit the dirt.
Use all that military training, you know. So when Sergeant Burroughs and his men filed their report of that night, they assumed no one would believe their account. And it's true. The next morning, people are laughing in the base, and there is Colonel Halt who comes in, and he sees a couple servicemen laughing. He's like, what's going on? And they say, oh, Burroughs and some other guys were chasing UFOs out last night. And Halt's like, why isn't it in the blotter? Taking it very seriously. Like, well, why didn't you write that down? He's like, oh, we just thought it was, like, we didn't think it was a downed aircraft, so we didn't think it was important. He's like, well, you need to write it down. So,
yeah, he was like, is there anything confirming that it wasn't?
Right.
Just because you don't know what it is doesn't mean it's not bad. Like, yeah. You need to write that down.
Yeah, write that shit down.
We should probably keep some tabs, you know.
Yeah, so Halt says, gentlemen, you saw something. Heathrow Tower confirms that you saw something. And now let's go out into the area and see if we can find any physical proof of what happened. So he's now, and this is what I mean about, like, everyone maybe sort of has an idea of what the person from the night before saw. So then they're looking for confirmation, mm-hmm. you know, confirmation bias stuff, yeah. basically.
Sure.
So later that day, Burroughs and a British police officer explored the site where Burroughs had seen the strange object. According to Burroughs, there were circular impressions in the earth directly below the spot where the craft appeared to hover. Basically, the craft had three legs, mm-hmm. and they were able to measure the indentations, and they were exactly, I think it was like 4.5 meters apart, making a perfect equilateral triangle.
Okay.
But the British police officer dismissed the circles as the marks of animals that had been digging there. but then when they were equal distance apart, that did seem strange.
Hmm.
Rumors of the UFO sighting had spread like wildfire, and later that morning, Colonel Charles Halt, who I mentioned earlier, the deputy base commander, said he was very skeptical, but that we need to figure out what is going on. He said, as events unfolded, I became more and more concerned that there may be something to this. I kept telling myself that there had to be some type of explanation, but I certainly couldn't find one. And even to this day, I can't explain what happened.
Mm.
So that evening, unusual lights were once again spotted in the forest. This time, Colonel Halt ordered large floodlights, which are called light alls, which I never knew, but you've definitely seen them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just, you wheel them in, they're just giant lights, floodlights.
Yeah, the whole time I was like, we call them floodlights. Light alls is so literal.
I love it.
It truly, I love it.
I mean, just say what you are. You're a light all.
Say it like it is.
I wonder if light alls is a British thing that they adopted at the base because they were in England, or if that's a military term.
Mm.
So at 9:30, Colonel Halt received word that the lights had mysteriously stopped working.
Ooh.
Base security was immediately ordered to set up more floodlights, and those light alls also did not work.
Now they're light nuns.
Light nuns, yes. Some of the vehicles also weren't working and radio transmissions were limited. Okay. So armed with a Geiger counter, which I have to say, I love a Geiger counter. I just love that click, 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 click,
you
click.
You are here for radiation. I just love radiation. To hear about it.
So armed with a Geiger counter, a starlight scope to enhance night vision, and a tape recorder, which Colonel Halt said he always brought with him in another interview I heard because he didn't like to take notes. He liked to just talk, which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Colonel Halt led his team into the woods. Suddenly, a strange glowing object appeared. As the object began to move away, Colonel Halt said, as we were pursuing this glowing object through the woods, we noticed... Oh, okay, so sorry. I should say before that... they see this object, and I heard his reel, which I don't know why they didn't play this in UM, because it would have been a lot more interesting.
Mm.
So before this reenactment, Stack says, this reenactment is based, like, directly off of Colonel Halt's voice recordings that are still around, and they're still around to this day, and I heard them in a 2018 BBC interview, which was... interesting to hear the real thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Just because you can then hear, like, his tone of voice, and can you hear anything in the background, which you can't. And you can't hear, like, none of the guys are freaking out or making sounds, but also they're military, so they're probably just, like, staying calm and waiting for directions from Colonel Halt. But he says that it's a reddish object. There appears to be some yellow in it. And the middle of it is like an eye that's blinking at you. And they do this in the reenactment. It's just kind of a glowing orb with a middle part that sort of closes and opens.
Mm-hmm.
So then they see, they're kind of following it around, and they see a farmhouse in front of them. And then the farmhouse appears to be glowing brightly from the inside as though it was on fire.
I forgot about that part. Yeah. That's wild.
Yeah, it is weird. And then the red object kind of goes toward the farmhouse. And very suddenly, the red object quickly breaks into five white objects that then disappear.
Okay, if they're not seeing a UFO, which they're probably not, what are they seeing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I always assume it's the government before it's an alien.
Of course.
Yeah.
Right.
Totally. So what the hell? What the hell was that? I would be equally uncomfortable with the government working on something like that as I would be with an alien invasion.
Right.
Yes.
That is what is almost scarier.
Yes.
Is that then when the military or the government, in this case, because the military is the one that's trying to say we see this thing,
yes,
which is interesting. But of course, there's people higher up than them who might mm-hmm. hide something.
Of course.
But yeah, it's like, what's scarier? Your government covering something or aliens coming?
I'm not afraid of aliens. I'm terribly afraid of what the government's working on in a clandestine manner.
Yeah.
In an abandoned farmhouse.
What is right. happening?
What are they doing in there?
Yes.
But then I feel like the glowing just went away after the thing broke up into five white objects and disappeared.
And that's the weirdest, most unbelievable part to me. But
right. Colonel Halt describes the feeling in the air, says it was very strange. It made your hair bristle, sort of like static electricity. You just had a very unusual feeling. And I don't think it was all psychological. I think there was something physiological about it. I think there was some type of guiding force behind these objects. Whether it was trying to warn us or whether it was trying to do something to us, I don't know. So then one of the members that was with Colonel Halt on his team was Sergeant Robert Ball. And he said to me, so then these objects that broke away, they disappeared. But then they start seeing more objects in the sky that in the reenactment, they look like circles that turn into moon shapes and they're sort of like traveling around each other.
Mm-hmm.
And he describes it as looking like a grid search, like they were boxing off an area and looking for something. That was the thought that hit me right away and it stayed with me over the years. It looked like a search pattern. What I find interesting is that they don't have Sergeant Ball described the red object at all. Like, why aren't they having him corroborate Colonel Halt's telling of the first object that they see?
Hmm.
And that also this object is completely different looking than what the guys saw the night before.
Yeah.
But I liked the search grid theory because that seems like a reasonable thing that an unidentified flying object would be doing.
Would do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, whether it's aliens or not.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That was a cool observation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Colonel Halt said as those objects or object moved about, it emitted laser-like beams of light. And so they kind of shot straight down and then they'd just go away and then they'd shoot straight down and go away. And eventually one lands, a beam of light falls right in front of them. Staff Sergeant John Burroughs, the one who saw the object the night before, wasn't on patrol the second night, but he says, I woke up about 3:30 or 4 in the morning, and for whatever reason, I felt like maybe something had happened again. For whatever reason. I don't know why. I just woke up and felt like something had came back. Don't ask me why. It was just a gut feeling.
It's like when E.T. and Elliot get connected.
Exactly. So I went ahead and got up and went up to the base. All of a sudden, a couple of blue transparent type lights appeared in the sky. They were all of a sudden on the horizon, and one of them broke towards us. The only time the light alls were working, as far as coming on and off when I saw them, were when the blue light passed by them.
Blue light passed by, and the light all came on?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I have no idea what caused the light alls to come on and off, other than the fact that the blue light, as it passed, made the light alls come on.
Oh, wow.
And then at the same time, 300 yards away, Colonel Halt and his team also had a remarkable close encounter. And that's when one of those pencil beams of light shot down right in front of them, very close to them. So once that object that looked like it was doing a grid search disappeared, it never returned. The next day, Colonel Halt drafted a memo about the incident, and you can still read this. It was submitted to British military authorities, who never acted on it. The United States Air Force would not acknowledge the episode either. Then, in 1983, a private citizen used the Freedom of Information Act to obtain Halt's memo. But not everyone was convinced by what it reported. So we see James McGaha, who's a noted UFO skeptic and director of two private observatories. And he says, and I really liked him. He wasn't mean. Mm-hmm. Like, we've seen a few like this.
He wasn't like us.
Yeah, he wouldn't belong here because he's not catty enough. He says, the burden of proof for any event that is extraordinary is upon those making the claim, not upon those who look at it from a skeptical perspective. Mm. Where is the evidence? Show me the evidence. And that's what science is all about. On the first night at about 3 o'clock that morning, a bright fireball, which is a very bright meteor, came into the Earth's atmosphere. And this is unquestionably what John Burroughs saw.
Huh.
But then John Burroughs says, no, I've seen meteor showers come down. It wasn't a meteor falling out of the sky. And it went up, not down. Meteors fall from the sky. They don't go back up into the sky.
Hmm. That is fair.
And then Colonel Hall also says, meteors not going to go up, go back and forth and maintain the position in the sky for a long period of time. A meteor is not going to send beams of light down. But Colonel Hall is on a different night and saw a different thing.
Yeah, so he saw a different thing.
Mm-hmm. And James McGaha, the skeptic, believes that both men are mistaken. He says, I think both of them are being honest as to what their perceptions mm-hmm. are, which is basically Allison's I believe you believe. What mm-hmm. you saw, yeah. But human perception is very, very easily fooled. And I think when they went out there to the woods, everyone was out there expecting to see a UFO. With a preconceived notion, the way you view things can be greatly influenced. So he, McGaha, also says for the next night, when Colonel Halt saw lights, that was a reflection from the revolving beam of a nearby lighthouse.
Whoa.
But Colonel Halt doesn't think so. He says, if it were just a reflection, how does one explain two different sightings in two different places in the sky? But of course, the first one the night before was also a totally different thing that they saw, that Burroughs saw from Halt.
Mm-hmm.
How does one explain the object moving through the forest? How does one explain the sighting in the forest by three airmen? There were just too many things. I have a lot of unresolved questions I'm not sure I'll ever have answered. I've had people suggest all sorts of things. Everything from, I saw the second coming of Christ, to the devil's after us. I can't explain it. I really can't. I know it was beyond the realm of anything that we experienced in ordinary life.
But either way, it's definitely biblical.
Yeah, those are the I've had so many things. It's either
aliens or Christ
or the devil. So that's sort of where it ends. Of course, they don't have an update or anything explained. But 20 minutes later, we've just heard about what was seen. And so I'm left to find many threads that are out there about the Rendlesham Forest incident. Recently, a dog walker uploaded fresh footage of the forest and specifically of the sky. And you can see in this footage a helicopter flying around, but then also it's kind of a cloudy day. And you see just like sort of blinking lights behind the clouds. and they're definitely up in the sky.
Hmm.
And they'll, like, blink in one place and turn off, and then blink behind another cloud and turn off. And it is weird.
Weird.
But it also looks a lot like many other personal filmings that we've seen of the sky and just something weird up there. But the lights are strange.
Well, and isn't it sometimes, like, it's, like, weird weather patterns?
Well, I was going to say it reminds me so much of Marfa.
Yeah, I was going to say that, too.
There were a lot of scientific explanations.
Especially on a cloudy day. Light travels differently on a cloudy day, right? So it could have been, like, a weird lightning storm or something, and there just was no other sign of it.
Right, right. It kind of looks like that. Like, it just lights up the clouds, So I read an article from The Telegraph that was kind of recent, and they mentioned this video that I watched. But then they also had more information from another man whose name is Jim Peniston, who was with Sergeant Burroughs that first night, and he wasn't in the segment. And he says that the craft contained or was covered in hieroglyphic-like characters, sort of like that other what is the other one that I had where that guy was like, I've studied lots of languages and this one doesn't look like any of those languages. And it's in the States. You can go visit. What is it?
I don't even remember what
people are yelling in their car. It's the one that looks like an acorn.
Oh, yeah.
I forget.
Kecksburg.
Nice, yes. Carlin.
Right. Yeah, so this one is like more like Kecksburg because it's actually on the big, on the out, he's saying, on the outside of the craft.
Okay.
He says, I estimated it to be about 3 meters tall and about 3 meters wide at the base. No landing gear was apparent, but it seemed like she was on fixed legs. I hate when we use the pronouns she for objects. I just have to say.
It's ships.
Why
do you hate it?
Because why don't we call them he? Because we think women are just objects just like these boats.
Oh, okay. I see where you're coming from.
I don't know. It's just weird.
My mother used to say, how come all of the hurricanes and natural disasters are named after women?
That one has always pissed me off.
But now they switch back and forth. It's male or female.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't used to.
Yeah.
That's fairly, it's certainly in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
It's a slow progression. Change is slow.
God. He says, I moved a little closer. I had already taken all 36 pictures on my roll of film, so we couldn't take any more. It was all full.
Drat.
So inconvenient.
This is the other thing I was wondering about. This is 1980. There are cameras. That second night, why is Halt...
Wouldn't you bring a camera?
Bringing out his tape recorder, but not a camera. Why?
That's true.
Three of them, no cameras? Everyone's film is full? Okay. Haven't run to Costco to get it, or whatever the English equivalent of Costco is. I walked around the craft, and finally I walked right up to the craft. I noticed the fabric of the shell was more like a smooth, opaque, black glass. Burroughs, however, does not recall this. He doesn't remember walking that close to it. He doesn't remember what it, like, how he would have described it as black glass. He says, oh, and then the other thing to mention is that the radiation levels recorded at the site indentations were higher than the rest of the area. But then in the BBC interview I listened to with Halt, the female interviewer made a good point, and I'll tell you why I mentioned that she's a female in a minute, but she is like, well, I know that in pine forests, natural radiation is common.
Oh.
So there would be expected to be radiation levels there.
More radiation. Okay.
So Peniston, is involved with a book called Encounter in Rendlesham Forest, and he writes, I left the forest a different man. I was in awe of the technology, and yes, a knowing that it was not an aircraft which could have been manufactured in 1980 or even now. Peniston and Burroughs say they have both since suffered from PTSD from the night.
Whoa. Wow.
So then this article mentions Two nights later, a different set of military personnel experienced a similar set of events, and that's Colonel Charles Halt and the others. And I thought, two nights later, in UM they say one night, the next night. So then I kept that, I couldn't figure out what that meant until, oh, I did want, so this article mentions some direct transcripts from the tapes from Halt, and some of the quotes are, "I see it too. It's back again. It's coming this way. There's no doubt about it. This is weird. It looks like an eye winking at you. It almost burns your eyes. He's coming toward us now. Now we're observing what appears to be a beam coming down to the ground. One object still hovering over Woodbridge Base, beaming down."
Whoa.
With that two nights later thing, then when I listened to this BBC interview for, I think it's a podcast called The History Hour, and it came out, this episode came out in 2018, and they also mention three different nights of activity. And so the third night was that we hadn't heard about is actually the second night, and a second sighting where it's not in UM at all. I don't know why, but Halt says that night, this is before he would have seen anything. He says, quote, "The on-duty senior police officer, who was a female, by the way, went out into the forest seeing lights again. Listen to this. Had some kind of nervous breakdown and was medevaced back to the States."
Ooh, I hate that.
What?
So then the female interviewer, who I mentioned before, is like, what do you mean? Like, tell me more about what you mean by this nervous breakdown and having to mention that she was a woman. Yeah, and he says, really? Quote, "She went into shock and had serious medical issues because of it." Okay, so I hate the term nervous breakdown used for a female any time.
He might as well have called her hysterical.
Hysterical, exactly. And also, where, I don't even know if this is true. I can't find anything about this female police officer. UM didn't mention it at all. Why didn't Halt mention it? He's the one in half the segment on UM.
It's true. Yeah.
So it's just like, has this story grown and grown now? And now there's this female police officer that no one knows her name. She apparently had a nervous breakdown, was medevaced to the States. You know, just annoying.
Yeah. The lore is growing.
So then he goes on to tell about the night he went there and witnessed the UFO. But he, in this interview, he doesn't mention the glowing farmhouse. He just leaves that part out. Which, why would he leave? Why would he leave that out?
Yeah.
Okay, so of course, there's so many theories of what this could be. The lighthouse is one of them that is widely speculated, even though the men say it couldn't have been the lighthouse lights. So then, in about the early 2000s, a man named Kevin Condy, who was a U.S. Air Force security policeman, writes a letter and apparently confesses saying that he was playing a practical joke on the gullible airmen.
What?
No. After the first night he went out
there?
Or
it was the first night. So the problem is he can't remember what night exactly he did this. I mean, he says he did this.
Oh my God.
And he says that he took his patrol car out of sight from the gatehouse and, like, you know, past kind of the forest, or a direct shot across the forest, but not far enough away that they couldn't see lights.
Sure.
They could see it through trees. And he turned on the red and blue emergency lights and pointed white flashlights through the mist into the air.
Oh my God. No, I love it.
He says, quote, "The bottom line is that that was not a UFO. It was a 1979 Plymouth Volare."
Oh my God.
But I mean,
this is like the two guys with the boards out in the fields doing the cross circles.
I just freaking love them so much.
And then probably it just became this big thing.
Exactly. And then, I mean, why do they then see this thing super close to them? I don't know. One of the guys says they touched the thing. Like, this is what I mean. It just grows. If that is the case, this is an example, like so many of them are, of confirmation bias. I'm expecting to see this, so I do. My brain it's the middle of the night, too. So your brain is doing weird things to you. You're supposed to be sleeping.
I think there's also a level of, like, when something like, we see this with witness statements. Uh-huh. When something happens really quickly, you really don't absorb all of what had happened.
You don't. And then your brain connects the dots.
So then you consult with each other, and you're like, did we see this? Yeah, that's what I saw, you know, like, and it becomes this thing.
Man, that is, oh my that's God. Delicious. I love it.
So Condi also says that just, you know, this type of environment, they're playing practical jokes on each other all the time. You get bored out there. I think this is common in like any military base or situation. He says it was fertile ground for a practical joke, and practical jokes are a tradition in the security police. And often there would be like one practical joke would then get repeated again. So maybe then the next night more guys went out and did that same thing.
Oh, my God.
Well, especially when you see, like, other people on the base are, like, giggling about it and, like, thinking it's funny. Like,
but if he was the only one that did it the first night, when he saw the reaction, maybe he didn't tell anybody. I don't know.
I don't know. And I don't know why he would take so long to come out and say this, especially after it's on UM. And I mean, maybe he was like, I don't want to embarrass these guys that have created this whole story.
Who knows? Maybe if you do something like that in the military, like, you get in trouble for wasting the time of these people. Oh, they're being paid. It's like filing a false police report. They're wasting all of this time. It's a crime to do that. So maybe it's the same kind of thing. You've got all these people spending all of this military money trying to track this thing down. They don't know what it is. And you're just some guy that's like, uh-oh.
Okay, yes. Here's a quote from him. He says, I was almost certainly the Woodbridge Patrol or the LE flight chief the night of Halt's expedition. All I remember was the laughing about the people seeing UFOs, so probably from the night before. Mm-hmm. It was not treated seriously at all on the base. It was a non-event when it happened, and the stories of the believers are the ones that have morphed over time.
Interesting.
If the U.S. Air Force did not make a big deal about it, it was because they were appalled that a light colonel would be so nutty as to take a bunch of security troops and some guys from disaster prep on an extended walk through the woods in a foreign country. The higher command carefully ignored it in the hope that it and Lieutenant Colonel Halt would just fade away. Oof. Ouch.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Whoa. Oh, these guys. Oh, man.
That is succinct. He's absolutely right. How embarrassing.
I know. And, So, two things. You can go to Rendlesham Forest now. Of course, it's still a forest, but there's a specific UFO trail, and, you know, they're trying to just milk it for what they can.
Get a little bit of tourism
money. Visit, like, you know, whatever the UK's Parks Department website is, it says UFO trail. This trail will stimulate your imagination, taking you through forest, heathland, and wetlands in some of the areas connected to the UFO sightings in December 1980. It is a 3-mile trail, and it's rated as an easy grade, so anyone can do it.
One hundo, put it on the field trip list.
Put it on the field trip. We're going. Yeah. And then if anyone is interested, there is a book, Encounter in Rendlesham Forest, The Inside Story of the world's best documented UFO incident.
I mean, we all agreed at the start of this it was the most believable one we've come across.
KB, it was like your one with the two women, right? I was all in for it. And then it was just heartbreaking.
I don't think we can call any of them the world's best documented UFO incidents, especially not this one since there are no photographs.
That's true. That's
fair. And that is written by Nick Pope with John Burroughs, who we heard from, and then Jim Peniston, who I mentioned from that other article. Oh, my goodness. And I didn't think I was going to give 45 minutes to this, but I guess I'm just like UM, and I can't.
You know what? I
loved
it.
It was good. It was awesome. Good.
Great. Thanks for your support in this difficult time of me having to cover an alien segment.
Oh, my gosh. I wouldn't be anywhere else.
And I just was so happy when I found that Condi stuff. I found it this morning because no one really is talking about it. So that was a nice wrap up.
Oh my gosh, excellent.
Okay, thanks. I love it.
That was fun.
What a roller coaster.
We love it.
Hey, Resolvers, spring is here, it's finally getting warmer, and if you're like me, you're already making plans to get out of the house and do something. If that's you, then make plans to get out to theaters with a friend or significant other to go see the movie Finding You. Finding You is an inspirational romantic drama full of heart and humor about finding the strength to be your true self. After an ill-fated audition at a prestigious New York music conservatory, violinist Finley Sinclair travels to an Irish coastal village to begin her semester studying abroad. At the B&B run by her host family, she encounters a gregarious and persistent heartthrob movie star who is there to film another installment of his medieval fantasy adventure franchise. As romance sparks between the unlikely pair, Beckett ignites a journey of discovery for Finley that transforms her heart, her music, and her outlook on life. Finding You is the perfect film if you're looking for something to watch that's fun, lighthearted, and funny. So make plans now to bring a friend, a family member, or even your partner to go see Finding You, now playing only in theaters. For more information or to find tickets to a theater near you, visit findingyouthemovie.com. Hey guys, Carlin here to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Real Paper. Real Paper is tree-free toilet paper made from 100% bamboo, and you know we love a sustainable option. I don't know about you guys, but nothing is more annoying to me than running out of toilet paper, and you've probably been using paper towels for at least a day, let's be honest. Then you finally get to the store, and all the toilet paper options are wrapped in plastic film that you know is going into the giant plastic island in the ocean. Well, Real Paper is here to solve all those problems. It's got plastic free packaging. Even the packing tape is made from paper. And you'll never run out of TP again because Real Paper is delivered straight to your doorstep with free shipping, and you get to choose how often you want it delivered. We also love that every roll purchased helps fund access to clean toilets for those in need. And you can use our coupon code MYSTERIES to receive 25% off your first order at realpaper.com. Go to realpaper.com, realpaper.com, and use coupon code MYSTERIES, MYSTERIES, to receive 25% off your first order.
Okay, so the second segment is an unexplained death, and it is the unexplained death of two teenagers, which is quite sad. So the segment begins with an old home video playing of Shane Stewart. Marshall Stewart, Shane's dad, says that Shane was a very lively, energetic kid. To him, he was like Beaver Cleaver.
I know.
So nice.
The home videos are so cool. I wish they would do more of that.
I wish they did
that
more often. Yes. I agree. It's so nice to see the people in real life.
I mean, maybe we'll start to see it more the more common it is for people to have had a video camera. But
yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
So he says he was an all-around boy, always having fun, always making sure that everyone else had fun. He had a lot of dreams and a lot of goals, and he was a very lovable kid. Marshall Stewart is the nicest. He's like father of the year in this segment. He's heartbreaking. He says that when Shane and Sally met, it was just like two people clicked on. There was a bond there that was almost inseparable. It was like the two kids were made for each other. Pat Wade, Sally's mother, says that Sally loved people. She would do anything for a friend. Sally tried hard to please people, and she wanted people to like her, and she wanted people to respond to her and love her. Oh, my God. I felt for Sally so hard in this segment.
Yeah.
Who isn't like that in high school? Stack says that Shane Stewart and Sally McNally grew up around San Angelo, Texas, a peaceful bucolic ranching community. But like many other small towns, there was more to San Angelo than meets the eye. July 4th, 1988 was a reunion of sorts for Shane and Sally. Each had recently returned to town, and it was their first date in nearly 4 months. And at the time, I was surprised because if two people are dating and they're teenagers, where are they going for 4 months?
Yeah, what?
So I kind of wondered about that, and it comes up later.
Okay. Mm.
And also, sadly, July 4th, 1998 was the last time that they would ever be seen alive. The next morning, a ranger discovered Shane's car abandoned near O.C. Fisher Lake. Fast food wrappers were all over the front seat, and the keys were on the dashboard. I also read that along with takeout food wrappers left in the car, police found a note written from 18-year-old McNally to her parents. And the note allegedly stated that McNally was unhappy with the situation involving her parents. Shane and Sally were nowhere to be found. Lieutenant Lewis Hargraves of the Tom Green County Sheriff's Department says that Marshall Stewart didn't feel like Shane was someone who would have left his car unlocked with the keys in it and just walked off. However, there were no signs of the struggle, so at first, Lieutenant Hargraves says they looked at it like maybe these two kids ran off to get married. Mm. Wouldn't they need a car to go get married?
Right. Yeah, like why would they leave all their shit behind?
You're not literally running off on your feet when you have a car.
When someone says the term running
run off. Yeah. You're not physically running off.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Marshall Stewart said Shane loved that car and he would never leave it, so he was very concerned that something tragic had happened. Mm. 4 months later, two skeletons were found near Twin Buttes Lake, 17 miles from where Shane's car was found abandoned. Marshall Stewart was monitoring his police scanner and immediately rushed to the scene. Stewart says that he got out of his pickup and he walked to the area. His gut feeling as a parent was that they had found Shane. In the reenactment, in which Marshall is playing himself.
I know.
Yeah.
He insists that the sheriff allow him to see Shane's body. Yeah. The sheriff warns him that it's gruesome, but Marshall says that he wants to see it.
Gosh. Which I would be the same.
Me too. Marshall Stewart says it was Shane. He was dressed in what he was wearing the night he went missing. Marshall says that he knelt down beside him and told him that he had found him and that they would take him home. Sack says that there was no forensic clues, but that detectives were able to determine that both victims had been killed by a shotgun blast. So, of course, here we go. Sack says that the four-month search for Shane and Sally introduced their parents to a strange and frightening subculture. Marshall Stewart and Pat Wade discover that their children were engaged in activities which many believed were linked to a satanic cult. It's been a minute since we've had some full-on satanic panic on the show, so...
We've missed it.
We have. We've missed it. We always love wasting the time of law enforcement to track down stupid satanic leads that aren't actually real.
Of course.
Stack says that in Sally's case, it appeared to be part of a desperate search for acceptance in the wake of a painful and troubled childhood. Pat Wade says that she married and had Sally when she was very young, so that she and Sally basically grew up together. Pat says they were like sisters when she was small, but as Sally became a teenager, she became more and more rebellious. And Pat says that she had less and less role in her life. Helen Williams, Sally's friend, says that she doesn't think she ever heard her call her mother, mother. It was always Pat. Mm-hmm. Helen says that Sally was very resentful about the fact that her dad wasn't around, and she blamed Pat for that. I also read that right before Sally went missing, Pat had remarried and had a son that was born about 4 months before Sally went missing. So I think this was a really challenging time for Sally, and that's why she was hanging out with these jerks that were doing drugs and pretending to worship Satan and acting like dicks. But I think she was a teenage girl, which sucks. Like, it sucks more than anything in the world. And she had a stepfather who I'm sure she didn't like. She thought that things would be perfect if her real dad was around, which probably isn't true. She had a baby brother at the age of 15 or 16, which I'm sure is a tremendous shift in an entire household for a teenager. So all of this lines up to a kid starting to rebel and be a rebellious teenager.
Gosh, yes.
Yeah, totally.
Stack says that Sally began sneaking out late at night, and on one occasion, Pat stayed up to confront her, and Sally wouldn't give her an answer as to what was going on. So Pat called a friend of Sally's to get some answers, and his mother answered the phone and told Pat that the kids were mixed up in Satan worship.
Ugh. Oh, boy.
I hate it. The woman told Pat that some kids had been at her house one night, and they told her that they had a demon in a bottle. Because, you know, all of those Satanists are just walking around
I'm a
like,
demon in a bottle. You gotta rub me the right way.
Oh, I love that.
Satan, there's a price to pay.
And it's just a small blood sample.
One goat, please. Helen says that Sally really got to a point where she thought, nobody loves me. So Helen is her friend. She is the only friend that's interviewed. Sadly, I came to find out that Helen passed away in 2006.
Oh.
But most of the information is coming from Helen, and we don't know how reliable of a source Helen was.
Sure.
Let's be honest. So Helen says that Sally really got to a point where she thought, nobody loves me. Helen says that these people came along and they said, okay, we'll give you that love and the companionship that you need. You just come with us and do what we ask.
I mean, which is exactly how cults work.
Yeah, or it's also exactly how a shitty group of teenage friends work.
Yeah.
You don't need to be a Satanist. You can just be a group of jerk teenagers, and that's par for the course. Think about Mean Girls, groups of Mean Girls. That's totally how that is.
Yeah.
So then there's a satanic teenager party reenactment. And there's candles and a Ouija board. And Stack says that Sally began to attend, quote, ritualistic parties on a regular basis.
Oh, my Spooky. Goodness.
One evening, she invited Helen to join her. And I'm sure Helen was like, what the? So in the reenactment, Sally and Helen are sitting on a couch and they're chatting. And then this teenage man announces to the group, it's Ouija time.
Which is always how it's done.
That's definitely how Satanists do.
Oh, yeah. It's Ouija time.
It's Ouija time, bitches. So he puts on this hood, puts on the hood of his wizard cloak, and he tells them to turn out the lights. Then the teenage boy says that they call on Satan to guide their oracle. And then Helen says that Sally went into a trance and it scared her, so she left.
Yeah, which the trance was just her being like,
I have to say that a teenage girl that wants to be loved would 100% pretend to go into a trance.
Yeah.
100%. Because yes. I was that teenage girl and I would have done that in a fucking second.
Correct.
That girl wants to be accepted. And if these people are worshiping Satan and challenging demons, she's going to be the first person in line. Truly the first person in line.
Yes. Just like you pretend to be hypnotized at your senior lock-in.
Exactly. Did you do that?
No, I didn't, but people did.
I didn't.
I saw many people do it.
Were hypnotized.
Yes.
So Helen says that half of her thought that Sally was pulling a stunt, but then the other half thought maybe it's just their kind of having fun.
That was such a weird.
So Helen came to no conclusions, really. She was like, she's either having fun or she's just having fun.
Either way.
So in the fall of 1987, Sally began dating Shane Stewart. She introduced him to her new friends. And according to Marshall Stewart, Shane's behavior began to change as well. They show a reenactment of Shane and Sally walking in the woods. And Shane is wearing the most ridiculous crop top V-neck tank top I have ever seen on a grown man. It is truly... Oh,
honey, there's multiple male crop tops in this segment.
I know, but this one has a spaghetti strap and then a tank strap and then a V-neck.
Yes.
Like, it really looks like it's a woman's crop top. Like,
I think he made it with his hands.
Oh,
like,
okay.
No scissors involved.
Okay, he just tore it?
Yeah.
Okay. Now I love it.
Hardcore male crop top time.
Do you remember when men would just, like, walk around in crop... Okay.
No.
Oh, it's gonna come back. You know it will.
I can't. Okay, so they show this reenactment of Shane and Sally, and they're walking in the woods, and Marshall says that Shane started getting into fights after he started hanging out with this group of people. So in March of 1988, apparently Sally called Sheriff's Deputy Larry Counts, and she said that she and Shane had grown disillusioned when some members of the satanic cult began engaging in criminal activities. Deputy Larry Counts says that Sally and Shane were members of a group and that they were trying to get away from it. She said that there were a lot of drugs involved and there was a lot of group sex. She said that... Yes.
I like his face.
I missed your face because I was looking at my
face. She did like a spit take without the spit.
Group sex is such a weird term.
Isn't it
group
such sex? A strange term?
Yeah. Kind of is like very professional, kind of like group sex versus orgy feels more wild, but group sex is like organized.
Yeah. It's like you sign into a spreadsheet, you sign into a sign-in sheet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You take a number, you get a dick. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
She also said that she had a weapon that had been given to her by another member of the cult. And when he gave it to her, he told her that he told her and Shane that the gun had been used in a murder/robbery.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. Why would she take it? No, thank you. I don't want it.
I think that the group of people she was hanging out with were obviously assholes. I do think that they were doing a lot of drugs and they were probably hooking up with each other, which sometimes comes with doing a lot of drugs, let's be honest.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God, yeah.
Sometimes that shit goes hand in hand and that's okay too.
Yeah.
But I think I could see them giving her the gun as a test, you know, kind of like fucking with her to see what she would do.
Okay, because I was like, why would you be like, just so you know, there's been some criminal activity involved in this
web. FYI.
Or they could have been fucking with her and then she like freaked out and went to the cops. Then Stack goes back and says that 2 months earlier, Shane and Sally had moved in together. They agreed to meet Deputy Counts in their apartment to hand over the gun. Counts says that during this meeting, when he first met them, quote, "You really would think that they were making this stuff up, but they seem sincere." The sheriff's department checked the weapon, and it turned out to be a stolen gun. Because of that, Counts believed them to be credible. He says that they did express fear that they might be hurt or in danger because it's a very, quote, secretive type group. And he said that they were in danger because they broke away from the group. So 6 weeks later, Shane and Sally moved out of their apartment and left town separately. But by early summer, both had returned to San Angelo. So that was when they are reunited. It's because they both left because they were both afraid. But then they decided to come back for some reason. And I really wish that they hadn't. They probably wanted to be together because they went to two separate locations, you know. So 2 weeks prior to her disappearance, Sally made a desperate phone call to Helen. Helen says that she told Sally that no one is going to shoot you. And then she says to Sally, "What did you do?" As if there's any good reason for someone to think that they're going to get shot.
Yeah.
Sally told her that she couldn't tell her and then hung up. And Helen says that Sally tended to exaggerate things, so she really didn't think much of it. And she didn't think to call Pat about it. And I think that, yeah, I think Sally probably had a big dramatic personality. Mm-hmm. And I think Helen was probably her down-to-earth friend who had grown up with her and was like, this girl, 9 out of 10 times, is blowing something out of proportion. Yeah. Or maybe she's lying a little. Or maybe she makes up stories. Mm-hmm. She's clearly a lonely person. I think that Helen just sort of was like, I love her, but I don't really believe her.
Yeah.
I think maybe Sally cried wolf one too many times, and Helen was kind of like, okay, man, this is just sort of what it's like to be friends with Sally. Mm-hmm. Marshall says that on July 3rd, around noon, a man called asking for Shane. And as Marshall walked away, he heard Shane mention money. Marshall asked Shane if there was a problem, and Shane said no. And Marshall told him that he could help him if there was a problem. But Shane said everything was fine and that he'd taken care of it. On July 4th, Shane told Marshall that he was going to go watch the fireworks. So Marshall said he hugged Shane and told him that he loved him and to not get in a bind. Mm-hmm. Marshall just seems like such a good dad.
Yeah.
Even being like, hey, do you owe somebody money? Like, I can help you. We can solve this problem together.
Yeah. Like not judgmental or damning about
it. Exactly. Yeah. Like so nice. So Stack says that police have reconstructed the events which preceded the disappearance. At 9 p.m., Shane and Sally watched the annual fireworks at Lake Nassworthy. 4 hours later, a fisherman spotted them offshore at O.C. Fisher Lake, 6 miles away. He saw the couple standing by a car, and then he saw a pickup truck approach. Randall Littlefield, the witness, says that he heard them say that they didn't want to be with those people anymore. He says he listened a little bit more, but figured that it was just a bunch of kids out there drinking and partying, and he turned in his boat and he left. I really would hope that something like that wouldn't happen today, because if you hear someone saying that they don't want to be around somebody and they're not going to get in the car with them, it doesn't sound like drinking and partying to me.
They need help.
Yeah.
Stack says that was the last time anyone saw Shane Stewart and Sally McNally alive. Marshall Stewart refused to believe that the children had run away. For 4 months, he scoured the lake area and questioned people who he thought might know something about Shane's disappearance. Marshall spoke to one of Shane's friends from the cult. Apparently, Shane told Marshall that he hated this person, and if he saw them, quote, they were going to be in a fight. Marshall says that this person had looked like they had been in a fight, but they claimed it was just a cut. But in the reenactment, if it's accurate, the actor is he had the shit kicked out of him.
Yes. Yeah. Half his face is a bruise.
Yes. His whole face is purple. Mm. Like the whole half. And he's got a big cut above his eye. Marshall says that he was convinced that he had been in a fight with Shane and that the young man was lying to him. Marshall thinks that Shane and Sally were hanging around by the lake and some of their former friends showed up and abducted and murdered them. Mm. Lieutenant Lewis Hargraves says that they don't have any suspects, but then he says that the people who have been named as being involved in the cult are suspects until they solve the murder. So I guess there are suspects.
Okay.
We have no suspects except for those suspects except over
for
there.
Everyone, all 10 of them.
Yes. Pat Wade, oh, this is so heartbreaking. Pat Wade says that most of her life she was fearful of dying and leaving Sally, but the tables turned and Sally left her.
Isn't that so sad?
I have chills.
Yes. Ugh,
that's such a beautiful way of putting it, right? That's like such a... she says it's the worst nightmare that any parent can have, and it never goes away.
And for them to end on not very good terms either.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sad.
I'm sure Pat was at her wit's end. Yeah. Having a shitty teenage girl is very challenging. Marshall says that there's no words to describe what you feel when you find your child murdered, that you couldn't console them in their last hours. He says that these people need to be caught and punished for what they've done to hopefully prevent something like this from ever happening again. He says he would like to sit through the trial and make sure that justice has been served. Stack says that when Sally's body was found, a fortune from a fortune cookie was found in her pocket. It read, "You'll always be surrounded by friends." Mm-hmm. Authorities believe that Shane and Sally were murdered by their friends as a direct result of their cult activities. Police believe that there are witnesses to the crime who are afraid to come forward. And there is no update. Mm. So, all of the information I'm about to tell you comes from GoSanAngelo.com and a couple of national newspapers. Everything obviously will be linked in the show notes, but I pulled a lot of content directly. On November 13th, 1988, hunters near the Twin Buttes Dam discovered the remains of Sally McNelly, whose body was found under brush about 15 miles from where the couple had parked their car. 2 days later, Stewart's body was found, about 75 feet from where McNelly's remains had been discovered. And they both, like I said, had been killed with a gunshot wound to the head. Mm. Police believe that more than one attacker was involved. Sally was working in a nursing home at the time of her death. She loved the elderly and animals, especially dogs. She had signed up for the Navy and wanted to become an RN like her mother. Mm-hmm. Pat Wade, who was a registered nurse with a home health agency when Sally was killed, continued to work but eventually left the field when she felt she couldn't focus the way she needed to on her patients. At first, Marshall Stewart, Shane Stewart's father, thought the crime would be solved quickly, and then he had to disprove himself as a suspect. When his son went missing, Marshall Stewart patrolled O.C. Fisher Reservoir after the lake and the park rangers had gone home for the night. He documented all suspicious activity. Sometimes he followed the vehicles between the place the two were abducted and where they were found. So yeah. Any car that went by, he would follow.
Of course he did.
He reported his findings and he tape recorded everything, and he would bring it to the sheriff's office. And then, like we saw in the reenactment, one day while listening to a police scanner, Stewart said he heard officers call for a justice of the peace. At first, deputies and rangers wouldn't allow him to the crime scene, but he was allowed in after he told officers he promised his son that he would find him. Mm. Hargraves told reporters in 1988 that Stewart recognized his son's boots and clothing. Mm. Marshall Stewart said, quote, "Sad day when you kneel down beside the skeletal remains of your kid and there's no resolution, and you live with the fact that those people are still out there." For years afterward, Marshall Stewart attended counseling sessions. He began his recovery journey at Compassionate Friends, which is a group for parents who have lost children. And then he created his own support group for families affected by homicide just in his area. Mm. So I think there were a lot of homicides in that area at that time of teenagers and children. At the time, he said he hoped to help people deal with the sudden spotlight in which survivors find themselves. In public places, people begin approaching you and apologizing, he said, which can cause someone to relive the loss. He says, quote, "It helped everybody because they had to learn to deal with the media and law enforcement and perception from the community, and they're under tremendous stress." And then I read that maybe 4 or 5 years later, the amount of violent deaths of children went down, so the group disbanded. So it was happening frequently enough that there were enough people to join this group, which is alarming.
Good night. Yeah.
Yeah. By 2013, more than 10,000 investigative documents had been filed on the double homicide since July 5th, 1988. A Whataburger receipt and McNelly's driver's license and hundreds of interviews were preserved and put in the file. Tom Green County Sheriff David Jones at the time said, "I fully expect this case to be solved and that criminal charges will be filed at some point in the future. A lot of people involved in this case were teenagers at the time, and they have since grown up." Investigators said that they know that there are people in San Angelo who have information or who were involved in the killings. With the time that's passed, they hope these people realize what the case has done to the victims' families. Jones said, quote, "We think it's time for them to come forth and talk with us. We're asking that from the public." Rumors of cult activity surfaced because of occurrences of animal mutilation that had turned up in the surrounding counties, but investigators said they don't believe it was the reason for the killing. So I don't know where all of this, certainly the satanic storyline is something that they loved it, right? Mm-hmm. They couldn't get enough satanic panic. You got to scare all those families in the Midwest.
Yep.
So really the satanic element came from Helen, predominantly, who was also a teenager at the time, and then Lou Hargrave's conversation with Shane and Sally. But he kept saying satanic. He never said that they said satanic.
Right.
So I think this was a group of people that were involved in crime, robbery, and drugs. But there was no evidence of satanic practices. And then it just so happened that they found dead animals in the vicinity of where Shane and Sally were found. And then just like we see all of the time, just like you're talking about with your segment, Eliza, it's just rumors and conjecture, people repeating the same story, adding their own flair, adding their own elements. Yes. And then it ends up on national TV.
It's a story.
Mm-hmm. And everyone's following the satanic panic angle. But I do think I got the impression that it did not last for long. I think it aired very soon after the couple were discovered. I think the police quickly ruled out the satanic panic situation. Sheriff's investigators, Sergeant Terry Lowe and Sergeant Ray Malas, reopened the case in February of 2013. Once the case was reopened, they did a handful of polygraph testing of potential witnesses and suspects and conducted one hypnosis session. And they sent away for trace evidence testing and DNA testing. In May of 2014, a DNA profile recovered from the scene where the two skeletal remains were found in 1988 was added to the national database. It didn't find a match, but Tom Green County investigators said they planned to collect DNA samples from people of interest in the deaths of Shane and Sally. In July of 2014, Cold Case Sergeant Terry Lowe and his team tracked down a person of interest in a foreign country with the assistance of the Department of State. And they also exhumed the remains of Shane Stewart for DNA purposes. I have to say that Terry Lowe seems like a great guy. In a 2014 interview, he said closure and justice for the family had remained his ultimate goal in solving the case. Lowe said, quote, "They don't hurt any less today than they did 26 years ago. We're working for them. There's an old saying in homicide that you, quote, work for the victim. It's essentially true. You become the voice for the deceased." Lowe set up a Remembering Shane and Sally Facebook page urging people to come forward. Investigators again said that they know there are people in San Angelo who have information or who are involved in the killings. Sheriff David Jones said that some people of interest in the case are still in the area and investigators know where they live. Lowe said, quote, "It's still the same people. For whatever reason, they were persons of interest then and they still are today." Sheriff David Jones was a DPS criminal investigator originally assigned to the case. Before 2014, the most the investigators had to go on was the physical evidence they collected at Twin Buttes and a scant amount of testimony on where the kids were seen that night. Other than that, it was lots and lots of hearsay. Lowe says, quote, "There were 10,000 leads back then. There were a million Crime Stoppers tips. The investigators back then were just covered up with information. You get a different set of eyes to look at stuff, and hopefully the answer is there. It's a local crime. Someone here knows the answer. Someone had to look them in the eye when they killed them, and that person is still running around." On June 15, 2017, the Tom Green County Sheriff's Office and the FBI issued a joint news statement saying that the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit had been contacted to assist in the investigation. The unit was given critical case information in which they were able to share both critical and investigative analysts and possible evidentiary opportunities. But let's go back 3 days to June 12th, 2017, because I was like, wow, why would the FBI randomly get involved in creating a profile, the Behavioral Analysis Unit? So June 12th, 2017, John Cyrus Gilbreth, 47, of San Angelo, was arrested during a traffic stop on suspicion of possession of marijuana, unlawful possession of a firearm by a felon, and unlawful possession of metal or body armor by a felon.
What? Are you not allowed to have body armor?
I think if you're a felon.
Whoa.
Yeah. Well, if you have a gun and body armor,
you're doing something wrong.
That's a problem.
Yeah. That's a problem for us.
Well, thank goodness I'm not a felon because I do wear my body armor every day.
I was picturing like a suit of armor.
No. I wear my chainmail that I make myself every single day.
You do love a LARP. So the first charge is a state jail felony punishable by 180 days to 2 years confinement and a fine up to $10,000. And the latter two charges are third-degree felonies punishable by 2 to 100 years in prison and a fine up to $10,000. So while they were searching his vehicle, the deputy found about half a pound of marijuana in a reusable grocery bag. I love that it's a reusable bag. Think green.
Well, you've got to be green.
Yeah, you got to be. So this reusable grocery bag was inside of a black backpack, along with a loaded 38 caliber handgun, a black lockbox with ammunition, and a camouflage protective vest in the trunk. A large plastic bag containing several smaller plastic bags were also found.
Oh. So
you know what they were going to do with that marijuana.
Not reusable, though? Excuse me.
We need biodegradable bags for marijuana. Like,
oh,
obviously.
My gosh. I have been talking about this for actually a long time. The weed industry is creating a lot of plastic, and there's nowhere to recycle it.
That's true. So a passenger in the vehicle during the traffic stop named Dorothy Salassin told police that Gilbreth kept ledgers and scales in his home and that he travels to Austin to pick up large amounts of marijuana to distribute throughout Tom Green County. I mean, I don't know if they had something on her, but she spilled that tea.
Mm-hmm.
Warrants were obtained to search Gilbreth's residence on the northeast side of San Angelo using the information from Salassin. Texas Ranger Nick Hanna, along with Tom Green County Sheriff's Office deputies and other law enforcement officers, searched Gilbreth's home while, quote, attempting to locate ledgers used in the criminal offense of narcotics trafficking. And they found items they said link Gilbreth to Shane Stewart and Sally McNelly.
What?
Personal writings, quote, specific to the criminal offense of murder that included the names of McNelly and Stewart were found, along with three audio tapes with SS written on them. The affidavit also stated Gilbreth was in possession of, quote, biological substances, including but not limited to hair, blood, fingernails, and the other biological substances that constitute potential evidence of a double homicide, which occurred in Tom Green County, Texas, on or about July 4th, 1998.
What?
Terry Lowe said, quote, Mr. Gilbreth has in fact been a person of interest since the beginning, amongst several others, but he did not elaborate further.
Hmm.
Lowe, who has been working on the case since 2013, believes it will be solved. Quote, investigators working cold cases are blessed with the work that has been completed by those who have gone before them. Time passes and evidentiary opportunities and techniques become available that weren't even thought of in 1998. It is said that the information to solve a cold case will be in the case file. In 2018, Lowe also said, quote, we get one shot to get someone in the courtroom, so we are gathering everything necessary so all parties are held accountable for this horrible act. This case is a big reason I am still doing what I do. I want to see this come to an end for the families of these two kids. 30 years is too long. So, Gilbreth was identified as a person of interest in the double homicides of McNelly and Stewart, but not charged. And he was released on bond for the drug and firearm possession charges, records state. However, he was convicted, and Gilbreth is currently serving time in federal prison for the conviction of those charges.
Hmm.
So, obviously, all of the Google alerts for this case, because I have a feeling now that he's sitting in prison, he might start talking about who helped him murder these kids.
Good.
Because it was definitely more than one person involved. So I hope he just starts yapping his evil, disgusting mouth and flips over those rocks and puts a little light onto the people that helped him.
Wow.
So I'm just going to wrap it up with this.
Because that last update was 2018, you said?
Yeah. So okay. 2018, he was arrested in 2017, and I was like, where is the information? So, and then Mike Lowe went on the record in 2018 and basically said, you know, we need to make sure that this is locked down. We've got to make sure that we can bring this to a prosecutor and they can get a conviction.
Right.
So I have a feeling they probably went to the DA and the prosecutor was like, there's not enough. I need more. Or let's let him stew and then let's ask him who was involved. Let's get him to flip. It's been 30 years.
Yeah.
Come on, start talking. Yeah. So I'm hoping that's what's going on. So I set a Google alert, and I mean, obviously we're going to update you because, ew, finding biological matter? What does that even mean?
Does that mean?
What did they find?
Oh, my God.
That's crazy. It's, ugh.
Like, does he have a weird Dahmer fridge somewhere that?
Yeah. How is it still around?
Who knows? And then, like, they never said what was on the audio tapes, the SS audio tapes. I guess they can't talk about it, right? Because they need it for the court case.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm very excited to get an update for this.
Oh, gosh. I think we will get one.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think COVID slowed everything down. But now that that's coming to an end, all these motherfuckers are going to rot in jail forever.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. So I just want to finish up with something really – a couple things that I read that were really sweet. So buried side by side in pink and blue caskets at Belvedere Memorial Cemetery, McNally and Stewart are not forgotten. So they were buried next to each other.
That's nice.
Which was so nice of the parents to do that. Yeah. To come together and to agree these two kids wanted to be together. Let's put them together.
Oh, my gosh. That is so nice.
Yeah. That just really speaks to their parents as people and understanding the love that they had for each other.
Well, that's why that the original theory, obviously, before their bodies were found, of them running away to get married didn't make sense either, because it's not like the parents disagreed with them being together.
Oh, exactly.
Maybe they wouldn't have wanted them to get married that young, but they didn't feel the need to run away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then Pat Wade said, quote, "We very carefully had her prom dress placed in the coffin.
Oh.
I couldn't put it on her because there wasn't anything to put it on. Marshall Stewart kept his son's Camaro for years, he said, but he finally gave it up. Quote, "The hurt and the reminders just became too much," he said. So anyone with information is asked to call the San Angelo Crime Stoppers at 325-658-4357 or Sergeant Terry Lowe directly, what a honey, at 325-655-8111.
Oh my gosh.
So we have a little bit of a resolution, and I can't wait for a listener short stack where we say, this guy gave up these other three assholes, and they're all going to rot in jail forever and ever.
Sounds promising.
Oh, and I just want to – I saw an actual picture of Shane and Sally. There's only one out there. That's a picture of them. Mm-hmm. And they were the cutest. Aww. So I want to say that the reenactors were adorable and they did a great job, but they did not do them justice. Aww. I can't wait to share the picture. It's so
cuties.
Cute.
Good job.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. It was a good one.
Segment 3 is a lost love segment about Carla Downing. And Mr. Stack intros the segment saying, "Imagine growing up as an outsider in your own home, feeling somehow separate from your family. This is how a young woman named Carla Downing felt her entire life. Carla's feelings of alienation were compounded by the tragic death of her mother when Carla was just 16. June 1965, shortly after Carla's mother's death, she and her brother went to live with her grandparents in Alexandria, Virginia, which is funny because that's where we were in my last segment, too.
Oh, huh.
So Carla's father was in the army stationed overseas. Then they do a reenactment of Carla being introduced by her grandmother to Mary, one of her mother's high school friends. Carla says hello to her and is acting really mesmerized by her. Like, she's, like, kind of staring at her as they're being introduced.
Right.
And she says to Mary, "You look really familiar." And Mary responds, "Well, I saw you when you were just a little baby." Carla says, "I remember thinking, gosh, this woman needs to sit down, you know. She looked kind of shook up or something." Carla says in looking back, she can remember what the woman wore, where she sat, and what she was doing at the time. Carla also can remember what she was wearing. Quote, "You know, it did come back to me, and I really wished I would have paid more attention at that moment." Stack tells us that Carla was born December 1948. Her father, Chester Libby, was an army sergeant, and they show a super cute photo of the two of them when she's a baby. Mm-hmm. Her mother, Mildred, was a secretary. In 1951, Carla's brother Ronnie was born. Stack says, but within a few short years, Carla began to feel like she didn't fit in. Carla says she always knew something was not quite right. She says mainly because of the difference between my brother and I. Quote, "He had blue eyes and blonde hair, and it was curly. And, you know, I had straight, dark hair, dark eyes, and an olive complexion." Oh, God. Which, as a side note, is an almost exact description of me and my brother.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Except that we look alike other than the different coloring.
Exactly.
Carla continues, "You know, it was just obvious to me even that we just weren't alike." But Stack says that Carla suppressed her suspicions and feelings. After Carla's mom died, her dad moved back to the U.S. and remarried. Carla graduated high school, married, and had a son, but even as a grown woman, Carla never stopped feeling out of place in her own family.
In 1990, Carla's father passed away and she traveled to Addington, Virginia for his funeral. Then there's a reenactment of Carla at the funeral and she's with an older woman. And the older woman gives her a briefcase and says it has all her dad's military papers inside, quote, and a few more. Mm-hmm. Carla said all she wanted to do was go over each and every paper and remember all the different places they'd lived together and that sort of thing. She says that in the back of her mind, she knew there was something she was looking for and she knew there was something in there, which is just so interesting. So that night, Carla started looking through the briefcase. There were two documents she found that stood out. The first one was dated November 1945 and listed Carla's father as married. The second document, filed November 1948, listed him as divorced. Carla was shocked to find out that her father had been married before he'd met her mother and had only divorced a month before Carla was born. So, of course, she's like, her mind starts racing with, like, I've always felt out of place. What am I discovering right now? 2 days later, Carla called her Uncle Norman, her father's only living brother. Stack says she asked him to tell her the truth and a surprising saga began to emerge. Carla says that finally someone was telling her the truth and her uncle told her that she was not her father's daughter. Carla says that at that point she actually felt better because at least she had a direction to go in. Like she finally had something validating these weird feelings she had had for years and years. An hour later, Carla's brother Ronnie called. He says that he found out from their uncle Ed, a different uncle, that their mom was also married before she had met their dad.
Okay.
So Carla's like, yeah, you know, I think that just means that I'm not dad's daughter. And Ronnie says, well, here's the thing. I noticed something peculiar on my birth certificate a couple years ago, and I looked at it again last night. And it states the number of children born to mom before me, if any, and it lists that figure as none. Finding out in this way.
So much. Yes. And not one parent, but both parents.
Very suddenly, you're like, where do I come from?
Stack
says that Carla's tangled family history finally began to unravel. Carla learns from her uncles that her mother had a series of miscarriages during their during her first marriage. In 1948, Mildred met a recent immigrant named Mary who was pregnant and unmarried. Quote, in that time and place, Mildred knew she would be unable to keep her baby. Carla's uncle said that they concocted a scheme to switch ID cards at the hospital. So they do a reenactment where Mildred comes in with Mary. They sit her down and ask her name, and Mildred butts in. Her name is Mildred Graham, and she doesn't speak any English. So by doing this, Mildred would be listed as the child's mother on the birth certificate.
So smart.
And just so easy to do something like that back then. Like, she doesn't speak English. It's fine. Listen to me.
This is her name.
Ed Norris, Carla's uncle, says she was about 12, says he was about 12 when this happened, and he always felt that Carla should know. Which I'm surprised he was even able to keep that secret as a 12-year-old. He says he always had a sense that someday the information was going to come out. Carla says she thinks it must have been really hard on Mary. She says that if she went to the trouble to go through this whole scheme, it makes her feel like her mother was really worried about making sure she went to a good family. Which I would agree. Like, it sounds to me like she was doing what she thought would give Carla the best life. Carla says she just has a need to find Mary and to be in a room with someone who looks like her, and she just wants her mother. Quote, I want somebody that I've been looking for a long time. And then Stack says, on the night of our broadcast, Carla Downing's prayers were finally answered. Carla's birth mother, Mary Maxwell, was alive and anxious to see her daughter. Stack says Carla was also... What?
I just remembered this true story.
Mary? I know. I know, girl. Stack says Carla was also overjoyed to discover that she had two half-sisters. 8 days later, Carla drove from her home in Tennessee to Maryland, where she was reunited with her mom. So, as I mentioned at the end of our last episode, fully filmed update for this one. So UM films the reunion, and the two just run to each other and hug and cry.
Too nice. Too nice.
Mary is so cute. I'm not sure what her accent is. They never told us where she was from. Yeah. They had just called her an immigrant, so I couldn't quite figure it out, but she's adorable.
And it was also like mixed with Southern accent, so she had this really interesting accent that from years of living, I guess, in Tennessee. So she's got this Southern Eastern European kind of accent.
Totally. That's why I couldn't quite place where she was from.
Super cute.
So Mary is just adorable, and she says all she could say was, "Carla, oh, Carla." Ugh. Quote, "And I ran to the door, and she almost fell out of the car, I think." And we couldn't do nothing else but hold each other and cry. Ugh. And it's just too nice. Carla says, "When I saw her for the first time, I just can't describe that feeling." And they do look alike. Like, you can tell it is her mother. Mm-hmm. She says, quote, "It's home at last. I can breathe again. It's just the happiest moment in my whole life, you know? Just the happiest moment in my whole life." So, and then they film Mary showing Carla family photos and, like, telling her who the different people are.
Yeah.
Mary Maxwell says, "It's like a miracle. I couldn't believe it for the longest time. I said, this is not happening to us. It only happens to other people that they find somebody they're looking for, not us. But yet, it happened to us." Carla says when she found out her mom was alive and healthy and okay, it was just the best news in the world. And the extra bonus was, I have two sisters and a nephew. So it's a happy ending. It's a fairy tale come true. Aww. So it turned out to be a viewer tip that led Carla to Mary. I don't have the details on what that was. Mm-hmm. But they were reunited September 27th, 1991 at Mary's home in Maryland. Obviously, Carla got to meet her sisters and her nephew.
It seems like it would have to be one of the half-sisters because there's no picture shown of this, of what Mary looked like younger, obviously. So it's like someone who knew this particular story is the one that would have had to have called.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Which if she hadn't told anyone about it, maybe she would have never been found. Yeah. But clearly she chose to, like, tell family members, I had a child before, which is not likely. Like, some people wouldn't have said anything about it and would have kept it a secret forever.
That's true.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, had to be someone really close to the family. So I did find Carla. I was able to link her by her new last name, her married name. I found her under Downing, but then an alternate last name was listed, which turned out to be her married name. But I only found that because I found Mary's obituary, because Mary passed away in 2010 at age 99.
So they got almost 20 years knowing each other.
Yeah.
That's so nice.
Yeah. So Carla is now 72, and she seems like a really, really sweet lady. And so I found her on Facebook, and then I found the sister that was in the reenactment.
Oh, cool. Oh, nice.
And they, like, leave each other the sweetest little comments, and you can tell they're still really close.
Too nice.
So it's just dream scenario. So
I
nice.
I love it. I love it.
Carla is a CNA and a licensed massage therapist. And in 2018, she started working for her local branch of the NAACP. So,
oh, wow. Awesome. Queen. We love her.
Yeah, and that is all I could find on this one, but that's fine because gave us a full update.
Yeah, so nice.
And it's a happy ending.
Yeah,
totally.
I love it.
All right. What do you have to tell me about today? What are you going to tell me?
I started watching Scientology in the Aftermath, hosted by Leah Remini.
Oh, my God. I've wanted to watch that forever.
Yo, it is bananas.
Is she have it? Does she have a guy on there, too, that was, like, really high up in Scientology? Yeah, I've listened to their podcast.
Yeah. I don't have his name off the top of my head. But it's crazy. It's super cool that she left and is now shedding light on what is happening over there. Mm-hmm.
She's putting herself in danger.
Yeah, she really is.
Yeah.
I had read a book. I'm trying to look it up, but I can't find it. But I had read a book about Scientology a while back by, like, this investigative journalist who actually was attacked by the Church of Scientology for writing the book that he wrote. Oh, it's called Going Clear, and it's by Lawrence Wright. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So I read that a while back, and, you know, not being a religious person, I find all religions pretty strange. But there's something exceptionally strange about her religion that is so new and was just created. And they're just using these really scary tactics to get people to stay in the church mm-hmm. and attacking them once they leave. And now that, you know, Leah Remini and this man who I can't remember his name and I feel terrible, but because they were involved in the church, they have all of, they know all of this information, they have all this knowledge, and there are victims of the church that when they were Scientologists, they didn't believe these victims. They thought that they were lying or, and now they're having an open discourse with these people and realizing how terrible, the terrible things that this quote unquote church has done.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really good. It's really good. Whew, it's something. So I definitely recommend it. You should check it out.
Are there still, I mean, like is Tom Cruise still?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Tom Cruise. Oh, yeah. A lot of celebrities. Tom Cruise, Elizabeth Moss, Danny Masterson.
Elizabeth Moss is?
The girl from Orange is the New Black in that 70s show.
Oh, Laura Prepon.
Laura Prepon.
Mm-hmm. Erica Christensen, who was in Parenthood, is... She's that if people are interested in hearing from a celebrity about it, she is interviewed on Armchair Expert because her and Dax obviously work together on Parenthood. And he's very like basically anti-religion. And they have sort of a conversation about like it because he's very open about like he doesn't agree with it, but he's supportive of her and loves her. Mm. And she grew up in it, I think. And so she's still Scientologist, and she talks about how it's like made her life so much better and all of that. It is really interesting to hear someone on the inside who's still in it talking about it.
I think for every one of her, though, there's like hundreds of people that...
Oh, of course.
And but, I didn't realize that it's sort of like it's an MLM. Every time you bring someone in, you make money off of bringing that person in. Every class that they book, every training that they do, everything they pay for, you get a percentage of.
Well, and it's like secretive until you get to the next level, and then you get to know what happens in that level. And then,
It's really, really interesting.
I just don't know. Oh, my God.
And I didn't realize either that they're sort of branching out into the Muslim community.
Oh, no.
And they're going to places like South America and other countries in Africa and, like, kind of bilking those people, too, in a way.
No.
Like, evangelicizing. That is the word?
Evangelizing.
Evangelizing to them. To them and getting them, like, to spend money on it, and they're kind of preying on the African-American community a little bit. It's just lot of really gross stuff. So, yeah, it's definitely worth a watch. It's very illuminating and really kind of upsetting about how messed up it is.
Oh, my God. Was there something that we all watched, like, a long time ago about Scientology?
There was a documentary on HBO called Going Clear. It was based on Lawrence Hart's
book. Yeah. Okay, I've seen that. Yeah.
I can go next. Speaking of Parenthood, this isn't my Jersey Feelsy, but if you have not watched Parenthood is incredible. My partner and I have watched it through twice. It is the best.
Is it still on?
No. Oh. You can just watch it on Netflix or whatever. It's so good. People should watch it. I recommend. And then this was the actual one I had planned. We've mentioned the show This Is Love before, which is hosted by and made by the same people who make Criminal. Mm-hmm. But I just listened to an episode from March 31st of this year called Among the Oak Trees. And I have never heard of this woman, but apparently books have been written and I think a movie is being made. Ruth Coker Burks, who... In the 80s in Arkansas, when men were dying of AIDS in the hospital and their parents and families would not go be with them, she would go to them as a stranger, and she became known as kind of like this angel woman who hospitals would call or start handing out her number to men who were dying. And she'd go sit with them while they were dying. And... she's like grew up Christian, went to church, and everyone was judging her, and it's Arkansas. And she's like, this is what the Bible says to do.
Yeah.
Like, why would I not do this? I mean, to her, it was just no big deal. Mm-hmm. It is such a good episode. And And the other crazy thing is her mother had, for reasons you'll hear in the podcast, bought like 220 cemetery plots.
What?
And so she's able to use this too to help the men when no one would take their bodies or bury them.
Oh my God.
It is so good. And she's a queen and we love her. And just that fucking 80s, the fucking AIDS garbage media that was out there, the belief about AIDS, you can hear some interviews from politicians who are just literally laughing about AIDS, about it, like, well, do you have it? Oh, that must mean this. I mean, the whole thing was not taken seriously the whole time because of who it was affecting.
The Reagan administration ignored it for like 8 years.
Yes. And then in a place like Arkansas, especially, she witnessed like the nurses just never going into the first guy's room that she helps. They just would never go in there. They didn't take care of him.
Oh, my God.
So that's... even the hospitals were not good to the patients.
Wow. Wow.
Anyway. Okay, so... you true sweeties have been writing those reviews, and we love to read them. They are so nice. They're warming our hearts, and you are following directions. We're very proud of you.
Oh, my gosh. It's so nice.
We got some international ones we thought we'd read, since I guess these don't show up on Apple Podcasts. Do they show up for them? Like in Great Britain, they can only see the Great Britain ones?
Yes.
You used to be able to click on other countries' Apple Pods, anymore. But now you can't.
That is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Okay, so from Canada, Ash says, these three ladies have the voices of angels. If you did not agree, you are sexist. Come at me. And then so nice. Cooper8989 from Great Britain says, hi, ladies. I originally heard the advert for your awesome show on a gaming podcast of all places. Truly. I needed something else to listen to, so I gave your show a listen. I started listening while in work and during my travel into work. During the lockdown over here in Ireland, we decided to change our kitchen via good old-fashioned DIY. So instead of putting the radio on like we normally do, I put your show on, and my missus absolutely was hooked. Myself and my lovely partner have never watched Unsolved Mysteries until now. We are watching all the shows on Prime, so I thought it would be nice to let you know. We did it back to front, but we got there in the end. Thanks from rainy old Ireland, Nathan.
Cute. Thank you, Nathan.
Too nice. They are just warming our little souls.
That's like one of the... like, maybe the third where people are being like, I remodeled my entire house and I listened to your podcast the whole time.
Yeah. It's so funny because when you do a project like that, I have very specific memories of what I was listening to when doing a certain project. Like, this is my, like, when I cleaned out my basement, that was my Atlanta Monster project.
Yeah.
which also was just filled with, like, deep, dark, horrendous things for that whole project.
Especially to be in a basement for,
Yes. I wanted to read one more. I've got so many I've collected that are so sweet that we will read eventually. And please don't feel sad if we don't read yours. There are just so many, but trust us when we say we read each one and appreciate them.
Oh my gosh, yes.
So Ryan M. says 5+ stars. I wish I could rate this podcast higher because it truly deserves it. So smart, so funny, so endearing. The hosts are incredibly smart, hilarious, and hardworking. The content is incredible. After each episode, I'm left with a podcast-sized hole in my heart. Getting to listen is a huge highlight of my week. Aww. Thanks, Ryan.
That's so nice.
So nice. Okay, what are we covering next episode? Episode 2 of season 4.
Okay, well, we just decided right before this.
Things have changed, and I have a legend segment of John Wilkes Booth, which was supposed to be Carlin's, but she said, no, thank you.
She said, I hate it, and we switched her.
So here I am.
What are friends for? And then I have a last love segment, and it is the story of Jim Baumgarten.
And then we have a missing segment about Alex Cooper.
Nice. So, Please go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast if you're interested in supporting us there. If you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you're going to get ad-free episodes, which is so awesome. 2 extra episodes a month, which are equally awesome, early access, and other goodies. To see photos we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at Resolve Mysteries Podcast and Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can contact us at resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or our P.O. Box 14005, Portland, Oregon 97293. Please, please send us your stories for listener short stack episodes. We're about to record one right now. If you want to email us your favorite unsolved mystery story, cold case, any sort of unsolved cases that are from where you grew up or where you're living now, we love to hear from you. It is so fun to get those emails and get those messages from you guys, and it's the best.
And please remember to put it in your own words.
Yes. Yes. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like us, leave a 5-star review. Please, please, please tell a friend. As you know, for every review we receive, we donate $1 to an organization. And this month's organization is National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. Also, for a limited time, if you leave a review, you're going to get a magnet until they run out. So, thanks for listening, and we love you so.
We love you.
We do.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Oh my God.
I have what?
Sorry, there's a huge fucking spider.
Did you see a UFO?
I'm not even like a spider scared person, but that is large. I need to deal with this. 1 second.
Show it to us.
Oh, no. Ed.
Black.
No, of course it is. I want to see it.
What's going on?
How are you getting it?
Oh my God.
She can't hear. I really hope this is picking up on the mic.
Oh my God.
Carlin, did the spider eat you?
Are you okay? When something traumatic happens, we have to make the person take out their headphones so they can still hear us or unplug them from the computer.
Totally.
That
totally.
Needs to be safety protocol. Oh! What's taking
Carlin,
so long?
Carlin, what's going on?
The doorbell is creepy.
Big stain on
no,
the
No, the door is behind you. It's open. It's the
door
spider.
Behind you just opened, Carlin.
It's so creepy.
Another spider's coming in.
Just kidding. Oh my gosh, but it left a big brown stain on my curtain.
Oh, no. Oh, disgusting. My child is not sleeping in that room.
Too bad. This is the room she likes the most.
Oh, we decided that safety protocol needs to be when something traumatic happens, the person who's getting up has to unplug their headphones from the computer so we can still talk to you because
yes.
You couldn't hear us.
We thought the spider got you.
And it was taking a very long time.
I can hear a lot. Well, because at first I was going to try to save its life because that's how I do. But
yeah,
then it was just out of control.
Yesterday, my child, there was a spider and... My husband was just going to get it with a paper towel. And my kid goes, but will that kill its life? Oh. Well, yeah, it won't have a life anymore. And she seemed really sad, and so they saved it.
Oh, that's aww. Those Carlton jeans, honey.
Carlin. Yes.
I love it.
Okay, here we go.
Sorry.
It was just like that noise again.
Right there.
I thought you were seeing a blinking eye.
An alien?
Yeah, we thought that the aliens came for you because you believe. Yeah.
Is that what it sounded like?
Yeah, it lasted, I don't know. People will hear it and they'll confirm. All right. So Oh yeah, so they see something. They've got that Geiger counting counter. Click 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 click.